Well, Chumash takes a turn in Parshas Mishpatim. We take a break from the Avos and the Jewish people and talk about Mishpatim, the Halachas. And it doesn't take long for the Mefarshim to begin their discussions. In fact, the first discussion in Parshas Mishpatim deals with the first letter in Parshas Mishpatim. Perek Kaf Aleph, Pasuk Aleph. Ve'ela mishpatim asher tasim lifnehem. These are the mishpatim that you shall place before them. And when we hear this pasuk, our eyes are turned to what's next? What are the mishpatim? But Rashi says, not so fast. The word ve'ela earns Rashi's attention. Any comments? This is from the Medrash, of course. So there's two ways for the Torah to introduce something. It can be with the word Eile, Eile HaDvarim, and here we have the Eile. What is the difference between them? Kol Mokum Shenema Eile. Whenever the Torah introduces with the word Eile, Posal Es HaRishonos. It comes to discount that which was said earlier. Classic example, Eile told us Noah. Everyone who's been mentioned before Noah is quite different than Noah himself. The generations have been degenerating, and now Noah is very different. Eile told us Noah. Ve'eile. But the Vav at the beginning, Ve'eile Andes, Mosif ala Rishonim, comes to connect that which is about to be mentioned with that which was mentioned before. And what is the connection? Ma Rishonim Misinai, just like the earlier, we're talking about what was earlier in last week's Parsha, Aseres HaDibros, just like the Aseres HaDibros were from Sinai, Af Elu Misinai. So too, the Mishpatim are all from Sinai. Okay, so the Vav of the Eile means we've had Aseres HaDibros, and here are the Mishpatim, they're linked. The Vav links. Vav is actually is a word in Lashon HaKodesh, it means a hook, as we know. Hooks things together. And then Rashi says, why was the Parsha of Dinim, Parshas Mishpatim, put next to the Parsha of the Mizbeach? That's a reference to the very end of Parshas Yisro, which is about the Mizbeach. V'mizbach Avonim, Tivneli, Mizbach Adoma Ta'aseli, V'mizbach Avonim Ta'aseli, and straight after the Mizbeach, we have Mishpatim. Why? Says Rashi, Lo Malach, to teach you, Shetasim Sanhedrin Eitzel Hamikdash. The Torah put Mishpatim next to the Mizbeach, for Mishpatim represents the Sanhedrin, it's Dinim, the Mizbeach represents the Mishkan, the Mikdash. The Torah put them together to teach us that we should put them together. That is to say, that these Sanhedrin, the Sanhedria Gedola, should be on the site of the Beis HaMikdash, or adjacent to the Mikdash, which it is. The Lishkas HaGozis, which is where the based in Hagadol of Yerushalayim was as on the premises or adjacent to the premises of the Beis HaMikdash itself. So to summarize this comment of Rashi, Rashi has said two things. Firstly, Rashi commented on the Vav of the Eile, it links the Mishpatim to what was said before, and then Rashi discusses specifically the juxtaposition of Mishpatim to the Mizbeach at the end of Parshas Yisro. Now, the Mizrahi, Rav Eliyahu Mizrahi, Rosh HaMedabrim of the commentaries on Rashi, has a number of questions. Firstly, these are the method of Rashi. We find Rashi discusses the issue of Smichos Parshios, juxtaposition of sections of the Torah, quite often. It's not uncommon. Lama nismacha Parshas Meraglim to Parshas Miriam, Lama nismacha Parshas Nazir to Parshas Sota, etc. and so forth. We will note, as a rule, Rashi's Smichos Parshios comment is always his first comment. And then he gets involved in other things. And the reason, I think, is very simple. Because generally, Rashi doesn't make general comments. He makes very specific comments. He treats each pasuk as it comes. He treats every phrase as it comes. And almost every word as it comes. It's a very itemized. So actually, Smichos Parshios, to talk about the positioning of sections of the Torah is almost uncharacteristic. It's a very general comment of Rashi. And because it's general about the Parsha as a whole, it should be mentioned at the beginning of the Parsha, and then Rashi will get down to the details. And therefore, our Rashi is something of a departure from that. Rashi has two comments. One discusses a letter, and one discusses a Parsha. And first Rashi discusses the Vav, and only then does he move on to discuss Smichas Parshas. In keeping with Rashi's norm, the Smichas Parsha should have been first. Lama nismacha Parshas Mishpatim to Mizbeach, that's a Parsha question. And now, down to details, the first of which is the letter Vav. So Rashi's two elements within this first comment are not in the expected order. That's the first question of the Mizrahi. It's a good shaila. Secondly, one good shaila deserves another. Secondly, says Mizrahi, Rashi will discuss Michas Parshios for the same reason that Rashi discusses anything. Namely, he's coming to resolve a difficulty in the Pasuk. If the Pasuk is all in order, Rashi doesn't say anything. Whenever Rashi comments, it's because something says Darshani, and Rashi says Hineni. That being the case, as we move to consider Rashi's approach to Smichas Parshios, juxtaposition of Parshios, we'll understand that Rashi will only make a comment like that, why Parshios are together, if there's a problem. What possible problem could there be for Parshios to be together? The background will be that we would not have expected them to be together, and therefore Rashi is coming to resolve and to explain, as he always does, why things are the way they are. After all, there are many Parshas in the Torah. Most of them do not have Rashi at the beginning saying, Lama Nismacha, this Parsha to that Parsha, because if one thing happened after the other, so then that's why Lama Nismacha. Parshas Lech Lecha is after Parshas Noach, because it happened after Parshas Noach. Rashi doesn't begin Lech Lecha by saying, Lama Nismacha, Parshas Lech Lecha. Which means that whenever Rashi asked why these two Parshas together, there's a subtext to that question. Namely, because I would have thought that something else should have happened. They shouldn't have been together, thus it needs to be explained. Says Mizrahi, do we have an issue with the Torah talking about the Mizbeach and then moving on to Parshas Mishpatim? If that's the order in which they were said, then you can't say everything at once. And that's why there's one after the other. That's why they're put together. They were said one after the other. So not only are we wondering why Rashi doesn't talk about this first, we're actually wondering why Rashi talks about it at all. The Torah talks about the Mizbeach and then Mishpatim. Who are we to interfere? There doesn't seem to be a problem here. But these are the two questions of the Mizrahi. And in classic fashion, Mizrahi deals with both of these questions by asking another question. And that is as follows. What is the answer? We talk about the Vav, the Eileh HaMishpatim. Just like the Aseres HaDibros are from Sinai, so too Mishpatim are from Sinai. Says Mizrahi, that kind of gives us the intimation that Parshas Mishpatim is unique. Mishpatim is put next to Sinai, it's connected with the Vav, because what's special about Parshas Mishpatim? It's from Sinai, like the Aseres HaDibros. What are the implications for the rest of Torah? What is Rashi's opinion about this? What is his approach? Well, anyone who knows anything knows the first Rashi in Parshas Bahar. Vayidaber Hashem Moshe Bahar Sinai Lemor, introducing the mitzvah of Shemitah, and Rashi asks, Ma inyan Shemitah Eitzel Har Sinai? Why does the Torah make specific mention of Shemitah next to Har Sinai? To teach you, just like Shemitah was given over at Sinai, Klalo Seha, Diktu Keha, Proto Seha, general details, particulars, the whole thing, so too all of the mitzvahs, says Rashi, were given over, Klalo Seim, Diktu Keim, Proto Seim, Misinai. Therefore, Rashi's approach to this question as to what was given at Sinai is everything. All the 630 mitzvahs in their general principles and their particular details. That being the case, Parshas Mishpatim doesn't seem to stand out anymore. It has a special teaching. that it's also from Sinai. Mishpatim is also from Sinai, along with the rest of Torah. So how can it be more from Sinai than everything else, which is from Sinai? That's a good shaila. In the roots of the matter, there's a dispute amongst Tanoim, a well-known dispute, Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shmuel, as to whether the Torah was given general principles at Sinai and details later on, or also details at Sinai. But Rashi has taken his side, Parshas Bahar. So we know for Rashi everything is given at Sinai, and therefore the question will come back, Ma nishtana ha-parsha hazos mikol ha-parshios? They're all from Sinai, but somehow Mishpatim is singled out as being from Sinai. So what is behind all of this? Says Mizrahi, if all mitzvahs are given at Sinai, general and particular, and Mishpatim is given special mention as being from Sinai, that means that it was from Sinai in a further dimension, beyond the fact that it was transmitted from Sinai. When we say that it's like the Aseret HaDibros, it was said at Sinai, what Rashi means to say is that it was said at the time that the Aseret HaDibros were said at Har Sinai. Har Sinai for us divides into two. Ma'amad Har Sinai, when we heard the Aseret HaDibros, and then the next 11 months where we were at Har Sinai and Moshe, amongst other things, received the Torah and transmitted it for us. When we say as a matter of generality that all 613 mitzvahs were given in their entirety from Sinai, that's a reference to that period of 11 months. They were all, over time, received by Moshe and transmitted to Bnei Yisrael. But when we say that Mishpatim is unique amongst Parshas, that it was like the Aseret HaDibros given from Sinai, it means that it was given, Mishpatim was given at the time of the Aseret HaDibros. That's what makes it unique. And this is also the approach of the Bar Tanura in his Peirush on Rashi, the Slim Peirush on Rashi, concurs with the Mizrahi. That's what Rashi means to say, that Mishpatim, when we heard Hashem speak, first Hashem and then Moshe, it was Aseret HaDibros and Parshas Mishpatim. That's the Vav. Ma'elu Misinai, af elu Misinai. Now, if that's the case, we look at Mishpatim now with new eyes. For we understand that the contents, the halacha content, the dinim content of Parshas Mishpatim is given at the same ma'amad, the same experience of Har Sinai, of Aseret HaDibros. If that's the case, then now we need to go back to Maftir at the end of Parshas Yisro. Because what seems to us to be a chronological sequence of events is perhaps not so straightforward anymore. How does Maftir begin? Berek Kaf, Pasuk Yutes, Vayomer Hashem Moshe, Ko Tamar B'nei Yisrael, Atem Re'isem, Kimen Hashemayim Dibarti Imachem. Hashem says to Moshe, say the following to Bnei Yisrael, you have seen that I have spoken to you min HaShamayim. And then the ensuing psukim till the end of the parsha. When were these psukim said? These psukim were clearly said after Ma'amad Har Sinai. Hashem says, that's finished, you saw that I have spoken to you now. And then we have the follow-up. Based on our analysis, we will now appreciate that these half dozen psukim of Maftir in Yisro are out of order. Because if you have the Aseret HaDibros and Mishpatim were all said at the same time, and then you have Maftir of Yisro, which was said after Ma'amad Har Sinai, that means that chronologically it was said after Mishpatim, but the Torah has placed it in between these two things that were said on that occasion, between the Aseret HaDibros and Parshas Mishpatim. That place is out of order. Once we come to see Parshas Mishpatim as being said at the same time of Aseret HaDibros, anything that's written in between is out of order. And we're entitled to ask, why? Why is it out of order? Which is a good question. And in fact, that's Rashi's question. That is Rashi's question of Lama Nismacha, why is the Parsha of Mishpatim put next to the Parsha of the Mizbeach? And our question was, well, do you have a better suggestion? Is it out of order? Is this the wrong order? Well, we now understand that it is. It's not a chronological order because they heard Mishpatim before these final psukim of Yisro were said. So why then is the Mizbeach put just before Ve'el HaMishpatim? That's a Rashi question. And a Rashi question deserves a Rashi answer, which is that the Sanhedrin should be put next to the Mizbeach. So we understand why Rashi got involved, but moreover, says Mizrahi, we understand why Rashi dealt with the Smichus Parshios question second. It wasn't his opening question. The reason why he did not deal with Smichus Parshios first is because if it was the first thing he would say, he wouldn't have said it at all. Because we would not yet have cued into the fact that the Parshios are out of order. It's specifically the Vav that links Mishpatim back to the Aseres HaDibros that promotes and pushes out Maftir of Yisro as being out of order. Once you've seen the Vav, now you know that the Parsha of the Mizbeach is not where it actually was said, so now you're entitled to ask the question, Lama Nismacha Mishpatim Eitz HaMizbeach? So everything is exactly where it needs to be. These are two parts of one Rashi, they're not two separate discussions, because one begets the other. We begin with the Vav, we begin at the very beginning, the Vav. The Vav teaches us that Mishpatim was said at the same time as Aseres HaDibros, and that spawns the second part of the discussion. So what's Mizbeach doing in the middle? Or in Rashi's terminology, Lama Nismacha Mishpatim Eitz HaMizbeach. So that is the classic approach of the Mizrahi to this rather innocent-looking Rashi in the beginning of Parshas Mishpatim, the Vav of the Eile, and the Smichas Parshas. Interesting to note, the Maharal in the Gur Aryeh, who's dealing with many of the issues of the Mizrahi, has a different approach, as is so often the case. Where there is Mizrahi, there is Gur Aryeh. And Gur Aryeh explains, again, the question is, are the Parshas out of order? Why is Rashi getting involved in Smichus Parshios? Is there a problem here? And Gur Aryeh says that Rashi's question in the beginning of Mishpatim, Lama Nismecha, why is Mishpatim Nismecha, together with the Mizbeach, is not the classic Smichus Parshios issue that Rashi deals with. Rashi is dealing with another issue altogether. How so? Says Gur Aryeh, let's ask a simple question. The Torah has many Parshios, it writes them in whatever order it writes them, but one thing we are entitled to expect. Namely, every new section of the Torah has a pasuk of introduction. That much, I think we'll agree, is a standard. The introduction will be either Vayidaber Hashem Moshe Lemor or wherever else it will be. Now, Parshas Mishpatim is a different issue than the Mizbeach. It's not the same. And therefore, let's ask an interesting question. Why does Mishpatim not begin the way we would have expected it to begin? Namely, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe Lemor, Eila Mishpatim Asher Tasim Livnei Yisrael. It's a new topic. It should have had that pasuk of introduction. And it doesn't. And that's Rashi's question. The Vav of the Eile links Mishpatim to what was said before. But the question is, but why is it linked? Why do we have what is essentially a new Parsha being presented as if it's just a continuation of the previous Parsha? We're carrying on as if we're in the middle. Ve'ela Mishpatim, still within the topic. We've moved to a new topic, from Mizbeach to Mishpatim. And therefore, says Gur Aryeh, Rashi's question, and sometimes happens, he uses the words Lama Nismacha Parshas Mishpatim to Mizbeach, but he's not talking about the juxtaposition of the two Parshas. He's talking about the merging of the two Parshas. The Torah has taken two topics, put them together as if they're one. The Parsha, because the only pasuk of introduction is in Maftir, Vayomer Hashem El Moshe, Ko Tomar. That's the pasuk of introduction. And what does it introduce? Mizbeach, and it keeps going. The Eila Mishpatim, as if it's all one. Lama Nismacha, why did the Torah put them together as if they're one Parsha? It joined them, it fused them together. The Lamedcha, to teach you, says Rashi, the Torah joined them together in that way because we are meant to join them together, to put the Sanhedrin together with the Mizbeach. They're both on the same location. That's where the Torah put them as part of the same Parsha. So it's quite a different, again, generated by many of the same concerns of the Mizrahi, but for the Gur Aryeh, this Smichas Parshas is not to be added to the list of juxtaposition of sections, it's its own list of merging of sections. So these are two, if we carried on with the Rashi itself, we probably wouldn't have time to speak about anything else. Mizrahi and Gurari just began the discussion. But the law that we learn, which is darshan by the Gemara, is that the Sanhedrin is to be placed next to the Mizbeach. And it is. And the Rambam paskens this in the Hilchas Sanhedrin. And it's interesting to consider the significance of this geographical juxtaposition, that the Sanhedrin should be next to the Mizbeach. And this is something that is discussed by Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal, and true to form, he presents to us a classic two dinim. That is to say, when the Torah says that the Sanhedrin should be on the same location as the Beis HaMikdash, it actually has two ramifications. It has implications for the Sanhedrin, and it has implications for the Beis HaMikdash. The first one, I think, is more well known. It has implications for the Sanhedrin. They are only fully functional in every respect when they are on site of the Beis HaMikdash. There are even certain areas of halacha that the Sanhedrin is not qualified to judge, or not authorized to judge, if they are not on the site of the Beis HaMikdash. Their full profile, their full definition of a Sanhedrin is when they are in the Makom HaMikdash. The Pasuk says, for example, classic case in point, Zokin Mamre, in the beginning of Parsha Shoftim, you have that rebellious elder, the Torah says, Vekamta va'alisa elamokam, you've got to go to that place, says the Sifrei, this trial can only happen in that place, melamed shehamokam goring. If the Sanhedrin are off location, they'd be maybe the same people, but it's not the same Sanhedrin if they're not in the Makom HaMikdash. So we see that the presence of the Sanhedrin on the Mizbeach adds to the full definition of the Sanhedrin. However, the converse is also true. The presence of the Sanhedrin on location of the Beis HaMikdash adds to the definition of the Beis HaMikdash. As surely as the Sanhedrin are not a Sanhedrin in the fullest sense of the word if they are not in the Beis HaMikdash, so too the Beis HaMikdash is not considered to be assembled in the fullest sense of the word if the Sanhedrin aren't there. And that's a very interesting thing to say. For it turns out that the full definition of the Beis HaMikdash is the center of Avodah and Torah. It is the center for both of them. And if one of those capacities is missing, it's felt in the Beis HaMikdash. There's something missing from the Beis HaMikdash. And interestingly, this is something which is discussed by the Netziv. In addition to everything else, all of his written works, we have drushes of the Netziv. And Drush Ches, the Netziv points out, the Gemara tells us in Maseches Yuma, Daf Lametes Amud Beis, that there were certain experiences that were common in the Beis HaMikdash that were discontinued. They discontinued 40 years before the actual destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara says, for example, it was a yearly occurrence on Yom Kippur, as they sent the Sa'ir La'azazel, they would hang the red thread and it would miraculously turn white. Im yucha ta'ichem kashonim kasheleg yalbinu. Says the Gemara, as of 40 years before the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash, it didn't turn white. They'd read that miracle didn't happen. Moreover, the well-known miracle of the Ner Ma'aravi, Lahalos Ner Tamid, whereby the oil for one of the lights burnt twice as long as all the other oil, even though it's the same amount, the Ner Ma'aravi, that stopped 40 years before the Churban. And the question, says the Netziv, is what happened? The Beis HaMikdash is still there. But as we know, 40 years before the Churban of the Mikdash, the Sanhedrin were already removed from the premises. They no longer sat in the Lishkas HaGozis. Says in Netziv, therefore, the Beis HaMikdash for those final 40 years is not, even the Mikdash, is not functioning at full capacity. There's something missing. And you can see it. There were miracles that used to occur. They don't occur anymore. Even Beis HaMikdash miracles. because the Beis HaMikdash is not the same anymore without the Sanhedrin. And Rav Soloveitchik, in his own way, draws our attention to the Mishnah in Masechet Sota and Daf Mem Ches Amud Aleph, which talks about various practices of Avelus that came in as stages of Churban happened. And the Mishnah says, Mishagolsa Sanhedrin. From the time that the Sanhedrin was exiled from the premises of the Beis HaMikdash, Bot Lashir BeBeis HaMishtaos. They didn't sing, or at least not in the way they used to, during their feasts, which was already an aspect of Avelus. Says Rav Soloveitchik, all of the other examples given there are Avelus over the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash. How does this point in time take its place amongst those halachas? So the Sanhedrin was exiled, and the response was Avelus, and it's Avelus of Churban. The answer, says Rav Soloveitchik, is because if there's no Sanhedrin there, the Beis HaMikdash itself has already lost something. It is actually the first stage in the Churban of the Bais itself. And as surely as there exists a concept of Avelus of the Beis HaMikdash, that begins with when the first aspect of the Beis HaMikdash itself was removed, which is actually the Sanhedrin. So this is a very interesting insight into the lesson that we learn from this Rashi. Sanhedrin, Eitzel, Mizbeach, as we said, each one empowers the other. The Sanhedrin is empowered by its proximity to the Mizbeach, and the Mizbeach is empowered by its proximity to the Sanhedrin. So those are some of the comments that relate to the beginning of Mishpatim. Of course, it's very difficult to know what to speak about in Mishpatim. There's so much. But I'd like to take us to the heart, certainly one of the arteries, really, of Parshas Mishpatim, and that is the question of Ayin Tachas Ayin. That will be found in Perek Kaf Aleph, Pasuk Kaf Dalet. And the Torah says, Ayin Tachas Ayin, Shein Tachas Shein, etc. And it goes on, has a number of similar phrases, and of course there's halachas derived from each one, but let us focus on the famous Ayin Tachas Ayin. What does Ayin Tachas Ayin mean? An eye for an eye. Rashi alerts us immediately, Ayin Tachas Ayin, Simei Ein Chaveir, if he put out the eye of his friend, No Seno Demei Eino. He gives him monetary compensation, the money for his eye. That is to say, this doesn't actually happen, that the aggressor, his eye is put out for putting out the eye of the victim. No, he gives a monetary compensation. Velo netilas eiver mamish. It's not actually to remove the limb from the attacker. Kamosha darshu rabbeinu beperek hachovel. As the Gemara darshens at length in Maseches Baba Kama, in the 8th perek, perek hachovel, daf pei gimel, and daf pei dalet. So, interestingly, Rashi here doesn't get involved so much in the details, doesn't get involved in the how do we know that it's money and not the eye itself. He just makes sure that we know that that's the case. And for further details, consult the Gemara. Now, the Rambam discusses more how we know. After all, the Torah does say, Ayin Tachas Ayin. So how do we know that an eye for an eye practically translates into the value of an eye given to the victim, not the eye itself taken from the aggressor? The Rambam states in Hilchos Chovel Umazik, Perek Aleph, Halacha Gimel, Ze Shenemar BaTorah. That which it says in the Torah, Ka'asher Yitein Mum BaAdam Ken Yinosein Bo. Whatever he, any defect or wound that he inflicts on his friend, so shall be done to him. Which sounds pretty direct and straightforward. It does not mean to wound the attacker in the way that he wounded the victim. Ella, shehu ra'ui lachasro eiver. Rather, what it means is that that is what he deserves. This is what should happen. He, olachbolbo kemosha asa. It really should happen to him. Ulafichach mishalem nizkar. That's why he needs to pay. Says Rambam. How do we know? Harehu Omer, the Pasuk states in Parshas Maseh, Velotikhu kofel nefesh rotseach. If someone is a murderer, you cannot receive or accept ransom for his soul. If he's chayev misa, he's chayev misa. He can't buy it off. Says Rambam, the point is, the pasuk states or stresses, lerotseach bilvad hu she'en kofer. The Torah specifies if he's a murderer, that can't be ransomed. But the implication is, aval lechisorin evorim o lechavolos yesh kofer. But if it's less than that, it can be ransomed. And that is the result of ayin tachas ayin translating into money. Okay. So the Rambam has opened this discussion for us that as much as the Torah says ayin tachas ayin, but we can demonstrate that it doesn't mean literally an eye for an eye. The pasuk elsewhere states, for a murderer don't take ransom, implying for anything else one does take ransom. We should know further that even in terms of the words themselves, ayin tachas ayin, on a pure pshat level, they do not necessarily mean that you take out his eye in return for the eye that he took out. For even the words ayin tachas ayin, the Binyan Shlomo, Rav Shlomo HaKohen of Vilna, explains that the word ayin tachas ayin can certainly mean the value of an eye, for an eye. Certainly. And he quotes an example for us. The Torah states later on in Parshas, in Pasuk Lamed Vav, if one's ox gores another ox, the Pasuk says, Shalem Yishalem, Shor Tachas HaShor. He shall surely pay one ox in the stead of the other ox. Says Binyan Shlomo, no one will argue that the payment must take the form of an ox. He can pay in money, there's no question about it. Shalem Yishalem. But the Pasuk says, Shor Tachas HaShor. Says Binyan Shlomo, we understand that what that means is the value of the ox. Tachas HaShor. So too, says Binyan Shlomo, when it says ayin tachas ayin, it is perfectly acceptable within the guidelines of pshat to understand that it means the value of an eye should be given instead of that eye, which is essentially what the halacha is. Okay, so what the Rambam derived from elsewhere, from the pasuk in Parshas Masay, no ransom for a murderer, implying yes ransom for injury, the Binyan Shlomo saw within the pasuk itself, certainly is not at odds with that. There is a well-known saying in the name of the Vilna Gaon that there is a further allusion to the monetary compensation that is the result of ayin tachas ayin. Ayin tachas ayin literally means, well, practically it means an eye instead of an eye. Literally it means an eye beneath an eye. What is beneath the eye that is of any help to us? Says the Vilna Gaon, if you look at the word ayin, so you will see it has three letters, ayin, yud, and nun. And tachas ayin means that one goes one letter below that, that is to say in the order of the aleph beis. Therefore, tachas ayin, to go one letter beneath, if you go beneath the ayin, the next letter along is pei. Beneath the yud, the next letter along is kaf, and beneath the nun, the next letter along is samach, and those three letters make up the word kesef. And thus the Torah alludes to the fact that ayin tachas ayin, what's beneath the eye, is actually what is happening here, namely a payment of kesef. So we have three rather different ways of arriving at the same conclusion, one from by force of extra pasuk, one by integrity of the pasuk itself, and then the Vilna Gaon from the world of Remes. The question, acharei hadvarim ha'ela, the question that needs to be addressed, however, is to note that we've only dealt with one half of the issue. Namely, the Torah says ayin tachas ayin. It sounds like an eye for an eye. It certainly sounds that way. So now there are two questions. If the halacha as we know it is that it's not really to put out the aggressor's eye, but it's that he pays monetary compensation, the value of an eye, if that's the halacha, there are two questions. The first question is, how do we know? And when we've answered that question, and when we've seen a number of answers to that question, there's still a question that remains. Namely, given that actually it takes the form of monetary compensation, why did the Torah write ayin tachas ayin, which at least seems to imply that it's the eye itself? These are two separate questions. The first is an issue of evidence for the halacha as it is, but the second question is a possible question. Why would the Torah not write directly what the halacha is, but rather write it in a way that it needs to then be demonstrated and proven that it really means money? Why did the Torah not say demei einu, yishalem tachas einu, and then the daf yomi could have their siyum one day earlier, because there's a whole daf of Gemara and Baba Kama devoted to this issue. The Torah, with one extra word, could have dealt with the entire matter decisively. The Chazon Ish, in the Sefer Emunah V'Bitachon, discusses this question, amongst many other things. And he says something which is a very profound statement with regards to all of Parshas Mishpat. The Torah, when it prescribes the punishments for certain crimes, says Chazon Ish, has two goals. The first goal is instruction to the Dayanim. The Beis Din need to know what to do if this case ever occurs. To that end, the Torah needs to tell them what to do. And thus, the Torah writes the punishments for various crimes, for various averus. But there's a second goal that the Torah seeks to achieve by writing these punishments. Namely, to serve not only as instruction for Dayanim should it happen, but to serve as a deterrent for the Jewish people that it shouldn't happen. As if to say, one shouldn't wait until he's inflicted gross bodily harm on his fellow till he comes to the Beis Din, and then find out what he's liable for. Let him know in advance, and that should act as a deterrent. And what's, of course, fascinating is, everyone reads the same Sefer. The very same Chumash that talks to the Dayanim is also read by the Jewish people. And each one is meant to get something else. For most of the Jewish people who are not Dayanim, why do they need to know the punishment? In order to avoid the crime. For the minority of the Jewish people who are Dayanim, they need to know the punishment in order to execute it, should the crime occur. But the second aspect of deterrent, says Chazon Ish, is no less a value, and perhaps even more. Because consider, and this is a statement about Mishpatim as a whole, the purpose of Parshas Mishpatim is not to know how to execute justice against crimes perpetrated. The goal of Parshas Mishpatim is that there should be no crimes perpetrated. That's the ideal. So the irony of Parshas Mishpatim is its success would take the form of none of it ever happening. Because people would never steal from each other, and they'd never injure each other, and they'd never damage each other's property. That would be considered success. Halavai. And therefore, says Chazon Ish, with an eye on the deterrent, the Torah chooses to write the punishment in the way that it does. How so? Because for the Dayanim, to know what the halacha is, it doesn't make a difference knowledge-wise if you derive the halacha from a straight reading of the word, or from a pasuk elsewhere, or any other means. The result is what it is, and the Dayanim know what to do about it. And therefore, the halacha doesn't suffer by saying ayin tachas ayin. But the Jewish people gain. Because in terms of someone who's upset with his friend, angry with his fellow, one thing we can be sure of, the words ayin tachas ayin serve as a deterrent much more than demei eino. If it's a different feel altogether. Because if the Torah says you're going to have to pay, it may simply be a question of whether he has enough money available. And if he does, he'll pay for whatever, all of his expenses, including damaging someone else and injuring someone else. There's something about ayin tachas ayin, that first impression, that will serve as a deterrent. It relates to the emotional side of a person. Ayin tachas ayin, no one wants to lose an eye. And even though everyone knows the halacha is, it's just quote-unquote money, but the Torah didn't say money. Everyone will remember, there will be a residue from that first reading of ayin tachas ayin before they found the halacha is that it's money. And perhaps they'll think twice, and then it's worth it. So that's a very interesting explanation of the Chazon Ish, why the Torah write. Again, the second question, not how do we know that it's money, but once we know that it's money, why did the Torah write the eye itself? We should note, and we mentioned this just a few moments ago, the Rambam himself has dealt with this question. Namely, the question of Ra'ui L'chasro Eiver. He deserves this. That's what the Torah is saying. Ayin tachasayin, he does deserve this. Practically, it will not take that form of him, of the aggressor losing his eye. But the Torah wants him to know that he does deserve it. That's Rambam's response to this question. That's why the Torah has said, ayin tachasayin, to tell you what you deserve. Now, what's interesting is, why does the Rambam talk about this? Now, it's very nice for us that he does. It's very helpful for us that he does. But it doesn't seem to be part of the Mishneh Torah. Consider, the Mishneh Torah is there to teach us halacha. Anything that is in the Mishneh Torah is there to teach us halacha. There may be other collateral questions about the pasuk that, if that's the halacha, then why would the pasuk write it that way? They're good questions. But the Mishneh Torah is not the Rambam's forum to deal with them. Because that's already not, it's not a halachic question, it's a parsha question. So if we had the Rambam's commentary on the Chumash, there the Rambam would say, if you look in the Mishneh Torah, you'll see that it's money, and you'll see how we know that it's money, and there ends the halachic question. Now there's another question, so why did the Torah write it this way? That's a Chumash question. Why is the Rambam dealing with a Chumash question in his halachic work of Mishneh Torah? That's a good shaila. If we take for point of comparison the famous Mimochras HaShabbos, Sfartam Nechem Mimochras HaShabbos, and as we know, the Machlokas throughout the ages, including the Rambam's time, what does Mimochras HaShabbos mean? And the Rambam says it means the second day of Pesach. It doesn't mean Sunday, it means the second day of Pesach. And he demonstrates how we know that in his way, and Rambam's job is finished. Now there's a very interesting question that is yet to be asked, namely, so why did the Torah write Mimochras HaShabbos? If it actually means, in reality, it means the second day of Pesach, why did the Torah write it as if it sounds like it's Sunday? Which is a good question. But the Rambam doesn't get involved. Because that's a Torah question. That's a Chumash question. I mean, the Rambam's job is finished. He's told you the halacha. He told you how he derived it. And you figure out why the Torah said Mimochras HaShabbos. But here in Ayin Tachas Ayin, the Rambam made a point of telling you why the Torah said Ayin Tachas Ayin. It's a good shaila. A very interesting approach to this question is found in the writings of my uncle, Reb Kupperman. And he explains as follows. We know that responses to crimes in Torah can take one of two forms. Punishments, for example, malkos, lashes, and beyond. And tashlumin, monetary compensation. A person eats non-kosher food, he's liable for malkos if he steals money, he's liable to pay. And those are two separate domains. Moreover, the halacha is that one act will not generate both. If a person, for example, burnt his friend's haystack on Yom Kippur, so there's a lot of things one could say about the person, but to get to the halachic part of the discussion, he would be chayav malchus, but he would not pay for the haystack. One act does not generate those two types of responses. If he gets malchus, then he doesn't pay. Okay, the Gemara derives it from the words kidei risha, so in accordance with his evil doing, one risha and not two types of risha. Fine. So you do not have onshim, punishments, and tashlumim, payments. They don't go together. The Rambam states, you see, it's possible for a person to incur multiple punishments. If a person ate non-kosher food on Yom Kippur, so he'd get two sets of malchus, one for eating on Yom Kippur and one for eating non-kosher food. And there can be multiple sets of malchus, just not two types of responses. And now, why are we talking about this? For the Rambam states in Hilchos Chovel U'Mazik, Perek Dalet, Halacha Vav, if a person injures his friend on Yom Kippur, which is a malacha, aside from everything else, if he draws blood, it's a malacha, he'll be chayav malchus, and he also has to pay. Now that's one for the books, because last we checked, if you're liable for a punishment like Malchus, punishment and payment don't go together. Says Rav Kupperman, in this Yom Kippur instance, if he injures someone, then we're not talking about punishment and payment. We're talking about two punishments. One is the Malchus for doing a Malach on Yom Kippur, and one is the punishment which takes the form of monetary payment. But that's a monetary translation of a punishment. For the Torah said, ayin tachas ayin. What should happen, the essential response should be that you should be punished for injuring him. Not to pay him, should be punished. You put out his eye, your eye should be put out. So the nature of this verdict is set as punishment. It gets translated into monetary form, but its characterization doesn't shift. This is not, when you pay him money for injuring him, it's not like paying money for damaging his haystack. Because the person is not a haystack. And therefore, if you injured him, ayin tachas ayin, says Rambam, the Torah is telling you, you should yourself be injured. That's a punishment. It takes the form of money, but that's a monetary expression of a punishment. And therefore, you get Malchus and pay as surely as if you got two punishments. They're both of the same set. So this is really a fascinating point, because we see that the Rambam's discussion, which sounded like a Chumash question, why did the Torah say Ayin Tachas Ayin, is yet a halachic question, because the answer to that question gives the profile of the payments for injuries. It is as a punishment, not as tashlumin, not as a payment. So these are some of the discussions of Parshas Mishpatim. We've actually missed out most of the Parsha, obviously, but these are certainly some classic and important discussions, because they shed light on other aspects of Mishpat. I'd like to conclude by taking us to the end of the Parsha in Perek Kaf Dalet, Pasuk Yud Beis. So this is after Matan Torah, and Moshe is about to ascend to Har Sinai to receive the balance of Torah. Vayomer Hashem and Moshe, Perek Kaf Dalet, Pasuk Yud Beis. Hashem says to Moshe, Ale Eli Hahara Heyesham, ascend to me to the mountain, be there, ve'et nolecho, I will give you as luchos ha'evan, the luchos, v'ha'torah v'ha'mitzvah, the Torah, the commandment, asher kosabti leharosam, that I've written to teach them, to instruct them. Now, there's a lot of terms there. Beyond the luchos, which is the only thing we've met so far, we have ha'torah, ha'mitzvah, asher kosabti, leharosam, instruction, commandment that I've written to teach them. And we should know the Gemara in Maseches Brachos and Daf Hei Omed Aleph, Reish Lakish, takes each of these terms and identifies them and associates them with a different area of Torah. And these are his words. The HaTorah, says Reish Lakish, the first of these terms, Zumikra, that refers to the Chumash. The HaMitzvah, what is the commandment? Zumishna, that the Mishnah is the first formulation of the mitzvahs, of the halachas. Asher kosavti, which I have written, says Reish Lakish, Eilu Nevi'im Uksuvim. That's the rest of the Tanakh. Leharosam, says Reish Lakish, Zet Talmud. That refers to the Gemara. Melamed Shekulam Nitnu LeMoshe Isinai. All of the Torah was given to Moshe at Sinai. Torah, Chumash, Mishnah, Gemara, Nevi'im, Ksuvim, the whole thing. It's interesting to note that as the Pasuk gives us these words which refer to Nevi'im Ksuvim and to Gemara, which clearly are the most in the future, so to speak, it refers to Nevi'im Ksuvim in the past tense, Asher Kosavti. But then the Gemara part of it, it's more in the future, Leharosam, in order to teach them. And it's worthwhile pondering why the tense shifted between Nevi'im and Ksuvim are referred to as, whatever it means, are referred to being in the past, and the Talmud is yet in the future. When we say that the entire Talmud was given to Moshe at Sinai, the Rambam, in his introduction to his commentary on the Mishnah, explains that not every halachic scenario is necessarily given to Moshe and then handed down. many things are disputes in the Talmud. Most things, in fact. Rather, what happened was that Moshe received the tools. Moshe received the midos, shatur and adreshes behem, the capability of deriving the halachas. That he handed down. Each generation received them. New questions came up, new scenarios came up. They applied these principles, and sometimes they arrived at different conclusions, which are the machloksim in the Gemara. And that's the way the halacha has to be. Lo v'shamayim. And therefore, says the Maariv Chayes, in his notes to the Gemara in Brachos there in Daf Hey, when we say that the entire Gemara was given to Moshe at Sinai, it was in the sense that he was given the capability of deriving everything that's discussed in the Gemara, because he's given the tools of Medrash Halacha, and which, if used, if applied, will give you all of the Talmud. Okay. Now, that's quite a well-known approach to this idea that we say all of the halachas given to Moshe at Sinai means the capacity to derive all of the halacha through. The question is, what are the implications for Nevi'im and Ksuvim? Our discussion so far has been about Torah Shebal Peh. What about Torah Shebichtav? What do we mean when we say that Nevi'im and Ksuvim were given to Moshe? If it would be parallel to what we've been speaking about in terms of Talmud, that means Moshe has been given tools with which to derive Nevi'im and Ksuvim, which doesn't really sound the same. The Talmud has halachic discussions. Halachic discussion can happen at any time. The Nevi'im and Ksuvim is the history of the Jewish people. Harder to understand how one could be given tools to, if one applies them, to derive those Sfarim. And yet, we find, and we've mentioned this on a number of occasions, that the connection between Nevi'im and Ksuvim and Torah is actually very similar to this. Nevi'im and Ksuvim, to a significant degree, function as elucidating works to draw out principles that are to be found in the Torah. That is to say, from a certain point of view, and we'll give in one or two examples in just a moment, the very first commentary on the Chumash was Nevi'im and Ksuvim. The Gemara tells us in Maseches Tanis and Tes Amud Aleph that Rabbi Yochanan, he was passing by Cheder, and then the children came out of Cheder. He stopped one child and said, what did you learn today? So the child told him, we are learning Mishle. The Pasuk states, Iveles Odom Tesalef Darko. Sometimes a person's foolishness can ruin things for himself. Va'al Hashem Yizaf Libo, and he gets angry at Hashem. Sometimes a person ruins things for themselves, and that's the time that they decide to remember Hashem. What is Hashem doing to me? Nothing. You did it to you. You should have been more careful, more organized. Whatever it is. So says the Pasuk in Mishle. Says Rabbi Yochanan, Mi'ikimidi, can there be such a thing, Dichsibe, that's written in the Ksuvim, Velo Remizi Be'araisa, it's not alluded to in the Torah? Can there be? There can't be. This idea must be found in the Chumash, because there can't be. There's nothing that's in the Ksuvim that's not in the Chumash. He just needs to find out where it is. So he thought about it, and then he found it. In Parshas Miketz, Yosef returned the money, the brothers' money, to their sacks. They're halfway home. They open their bags. They find the money, and they say, Ma zos asa Elokim lanu? What is God doing to us? Says Rabbi Yochanan, nothing. Why didn't you check your bags before you left? Iveles adam to salif darker. They didn't seem a bit heavy, a bit hard on the bottom. You should have checked them. That's normal protocol. And you didn't. And now you're in trouble. And you say, what's God doing to me? Should have checked your bags. That's bichlal, interesting. It seems to me that we derive more from that passage of the Gemara from Rabbi Yochanan's original question than we do from his answer. Because his answer found this principle, but in his question it was inconceivable that it wouldn't be found, because everything that's in Ksuvim is to be found in Torah. Similarly, in the Gemara in Maseches Yumin, Daf Lamed Ches Lamed Beis, presents an exchange between two two Amoraim. One of them asked the other, what is the source for the idea of Zecher Tzadik Livracha? It's a phrase that we're familiar with. And where does it come from? So he responded and said, the Pasuk in Mishle says Zecher Tzadik Livracha. That's the source. To which the first rabbi said, no, I didn't mean where is the source in Mishle. I mean, where is the source in the Torah? Which is interesting. Because once again, from the question, we see a premise. It's ironclad. I know everyone knows it's in Mishle, but it's got to be in the Torah. I wonder if you know where it is. So he thought about it, and he found it, wherever it would be. Some learn it from Parshas Noach, Eile Toldos Noach, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, Parshas Vayera, Avram, Hayo Yiyeh L'Goy Gadol, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. From those two Gemaras, we see that, and again, they're similar in that the premise behind the question is instructive for us, because it was axiomatic to them that if it's in the Ksuvim, it's got to be in the Chumash, somewhere, set to find it. And indeed, the Netziv says in his introduction to the Hamik Sheila, his Pirush on the Sheiltas, this is the explanation of the Gemara in Maseches Nedarim in Daf Kaf Beis. The Gemara says if the Jewish people hadn't sinned at the Chet HaEgel, they wouldn't have received Nevi'im and Ksuvim. They only would have had Chamisha Chumshei Torah and Sefer Yehoshua, which has the borders of Eretz Yisrael. So the Netziv says, as sins go, it sounds like we didn't do too badly out of it. And we fell at the Eikel, and we got many more Sfarim of Tanakh, 18 more Sfarim of Tanakh. Wrongdoings aren't normally rewarded in that way. And would have been better had we not done the Eikel, we would have been deprived of all of those important lessons. Says the Netziv, we wouldn't have been deprived of any of those lessons. Everything that the Nevi'im and Ksuvim teach us, had we not sinned at the Eikel, we would have been able to derive from the Chumash. We wouldn't have needed Nevi'im and Ksuvim. But having done the Eikel, our vision dimmed, and now we need it to be spelled out in Nevi'im and Ksuvim. So says the Netziv. And therefore, from a certain point of view, there's a similar relationship to Halacha as it will become. It can be encapsulated in the Midrash HaTorah Nedreshes Bahem, as was given to Moshe. And so can Nevi'im and Ksuvim. It's encapsulated in the Chumash. The difference between them is the halacha is potentially a product of the Midrash HaTorah Nedreshes Bahem. They need to be applied in order to derive it. The lessons of Nevi'im and Ksuvim already exist in the Chumash. They just need to be found. That's the difference between them. The Midrash HaTorah Nedreshes Bahem give the Beis Din the potential to derive halachas. Nevi'im and Ksuvim are elucidations as to what is already to be written in the Chumash. And I believe, therefore, that is why, as the Torah describes these broader areas of Torah, Talmud, Gemara, that is, and Nevi'im and Ksuvim, when it comes to Nevi'im and Ksuvim, it's written in the past tense, Kasavti, because Nevi'im and Ksuvim are all about things that have already been written in the Chumash. Talmud has not yet already been written in the Chumash. There are tools to derive it, leharosam, in order to bring it out, in order to bring it about, and to derive the halacha. So these, I believe, again, are sort of important discussions. We began with Mishpatim, with the Vav of Mishpatim, then to the heart of Mishpatim, but at the end, we have discussions that relate to the entire Torah and their relationships, one with the other. We'll leave it over there for this evening.